Programming is supported by Topline Construction Firm, your local women-owned roofing contractor based out of Shoreview, Minnesota. Roof replacement, both retail and insurance work. More information at toplineconstructionfirm.com.
You're listening to a recording of a live radio show on NPR News. If you want to listen to us in real time, you can stream our show live weekdays at 9 a.m. Central. Thanks for listening and enjoy the show.
Good morning, I'm Carrie Miller. This is NPR News. This hour, our election season series, This American Moment. We're talking with writers and activists, religious leaders, scholars, and scientists about the long view, where we are in this moment of American life, and what it says about who we are as Americans. Emory University's Carol Anderson, identity politics podcaster Ikhlas Salim are among our guests. And you can find the whole series by searching NPR News with Carrie Miller. Today, social psychologist Mahzarin Banaji. She studies unconscious bias at Harvard, and she's co-author with Anthony Greenwald of the book Blind Spot, Hidden Biases of Good People. She joins us today from Cambridge, Massachusetts. And Professor Banaji, welcome. It's really good to have you for the series and on the show. Thank you.
Well, thank you, Carrie.
I was preparing for a conversation at, this is just coincidental, at the same time that I was reading Cambridge University Professor Mary Beard's new book, Women in Power. If you've read it, you know that she follows misogyny back to the days of ancient Greece. And one of the things that she writes about is how the actual sound of women's voices is seen and the unconscious bias that we bring to this idea of a higher tone, a higher pitch, and that this is somehow baked into us, wired into us, that we believe without really knowing why, that men with their lower pitches carry more authority. Does this fit into your idea of unconscious bias and social psychology?
Well, I'm so glad that you're beginning with voice and even maybe accent, because we've just done a little piece on a program that we run called Outsmarting Human Minds. And it turns out that, yes, the pitch of a voice is an indicator of so many things. A voice is like an auditory face. You look at a face or you listen to a voice, and immediately our brain tries to make meaning out of it. Who is this person? Where are they from? How smart are they? Can we trust them? And the data on pitch certainly indicate that lower pitched voices have greater authority for one simple reason. For centuries, voices of authority have been male voices. So it's not surprising where it's coming from. The difficulty in the modern world is that businesses, for example, may be willing to give up money to pick a low-pitched voice. There are data on male and female voices making pitches to venture capitalists, and I believe the typical pitch is about 5 minutes. And so if you give the exact same pitch, the same idea, the same content in a male or female voice, the data show the preference will be for the male voice. And I argue that, yes, it's true that this is discriminatory, but even more interesting, you are costing yourself the better person.
This is so much fun to talk to you about this because, of course, I live in radio and I think often about the quality of voice and the sound of voice and how I and my guests are communicating this. And I fight my own implicit bias. If I have a guest on the show, perhaps a woman who has a higher pitch, I have to really fight what I think is implicit bias against believing that she knows as much about that topic as I want her to know to be on the show. How have I developed this, Mahzarin, with somebody who wants to be aware of it?
Yeah. Well, first of all, I would say kudos to you. You're aware of it. The difficulty is not, I mean, of course, we all have it. I often in my lectures do an imitation of a kid who walked into my office, a college student, to give me an idea. And I shooed her out of my office because I realized later she had been speaking very much like a Valley Girl. So I actually do an imitation of the Valley Girl voice. And I say, what am I supposed to do with people who don't know how to put a period at the end of their sentences? What am I supposed to do with somebody who says like three times in a sentence? But then I say that the problem is not hers to fix. It's mine to fix, that she should speak exactly the way her generation thinks is cool to speak. I don't think it's cool, but they do. And my job is to make sure that my university, my lab, my work is not cost because I didn't get to the heart of the idea. But practicing that, I think every time now, you know, trying to associate the Valley Girl voice with brilliance is something we can do. Right? We can do that because today, not just Valley Girl women, but men, parents of young children, all speak that way. So it would really not be very wise for me to use that accent. But the one thing I want to tell you about accents as opposed to pitch.
Yes, I was just going to ask. Yeah.
Is that the data are really clear on that. We looked at a meta-analysis of all the accent studies that have been done, and there are two interesting results that come out. Yes, it's true that we like people who sound like us, but much more interesting is the fact that we ascribe certain features to certain accents such that even a young kid, an eight-year-old in the South, will say, in the South of the United States, will say that she likes another kid. She thinks that the other kid who sounds Southern is nicer and warmer, but that the kid who speaks with the Northern accent is smarter.
Wow.
And this is what I find so interesting. And so often when I try to teach about this work to, you know, governmental agencies or corporations, and we talk about the difficulties of interviewing and all the things that can go wrong in a face-to-face interview, and they say to me, well, if that's the case, shouldn't we be just doing voice interviews? And I say, you could, but then you'll only hire British people. and I think that, these are well known to us that I mean, just think about it. Like a British voice says something stupid and you will believe it. It will sound smart to you, you know? And so this is worth knowing in the same way I argue that I'd want to know if something's wrong with my body, even if it doesn't show on the surface. You know, a common cold is simple because I know I have one. But what do I do about hypertension? You know, what do I do about a tumor I don't know about? I like looking below the surface, and accents are one such place.
You know, what you've just described has some pretty deep implications when you consider how the demography of America is changing. We are a country full of different accents and different ways of speaking, and that is only going to deepen. What does that mean for those of us who, I don't know, hear a Mexican accent? Mexican-influenced speech and instantly bring perceptions to that.
Yeah. Yeah. So people often say to me, well, maybe my bias is really useful because I'm using some useful knowledge to make some predictions about people. And I often say, you know what, in an older world, it might have worked. When the son of a blacksmith became a blacksmith and the son of a silversmith became a silversmith, you didn't have to think very hard. But think about our world today, where you have no idea who even has power. I mean, there have been these amazing instances recently on a particular airline where a passenger has taken ill and a black woman has said, I can help. I'm a doctor. And in both cases, the flight attendant said, you know, something like, sit down, sweetie, I'll get to you when I'm done with this emergency. And then when it became clear that people were pointing out that this black woman was a doctor, the flight attendant in both cases said, may I see your credentials? So wow. This has been out on Twitter. I've watched, you know, both of them write, one of them speak on TV. And I think that's what we have to confront, because in our world, it would be silly to assume that when you look at somebody, you even know what they do. That's how wonderfully diverse our world is in the context of who does what.
And lest our listeners believe that this is some kind of lecture where you've figured it out and I'm your acolyte, I mean, you know, a self-aware social psychologist like yourself also runs into these situations where I think, what, you were having a surgery and the anesthesiologist who, am I right about this?
You are so right about that. This was many years ago, but I think that, you know, when I described the flight attendant's mistake, it is, when I speak about that event to a large audience, they gasp because they think, who is that horrible flight attendant? And my next sentence is, that could be me. That could be, I dare say, you. And I give this example that I was being taken in for surgery. I told the nurse that I'd like to speak to the anesthesiologist to give her some additional information about my medical conditions. And she said to me, I am your anesthesiologist. And I remember when I went back to class to teach, I told them about the incident. This was before I even began to do this kind of work. And I said to them, you know what? You do not want an irritated anesthesiologist trying to keep you alive during surgery. This is not good for me. That's how much the world has changed that I have to worry now.
You and I have been, I think I specifically have been using the word implicit and not subconscious. And I'm doing that because I've read a lot of background about you. But I think we need to explain why the words and the language on this matter. Why do they matter?
First of all, you know, in our science, if we wanted to understand the human mind, we would ask people questions. You know, what other way did we have with non-human animals, with babies? We don't have the luxury of asking questions. So we had smartly figured out ways of observing their behavior in other ways to draw out what might be going on in their mind. But with human adults, it's easy to say, how do you feel? How do you feel about the country right now? Or how do you feel about, you know, a particular topic, whatever it might be, climate change, evolution, gun control? And having that luxury led us to just rely on what we call verbal self-report. And then as technology became available, we began to look under the surface and we began to look at things people may not be able to report but may still be in their heads, may still affect their behavior. And in doing that work, we struggled with the terms that we should use. And of course, there was, you know, a massive tradition in psychology and certainly in psychiatry that came from psychoanalysis, and the term there was the unconscious. But when Freud and psychoanalysts use that term, they mean something very different than what we're talking about today. Their unconscious was deep and dark. It had to do with, you know, what your mother said and did when you were 5 years old. And that's not what we're studying. So we, to distinguish ourselves from that tradition, which we have almost nothing to do with, we had to find alternative words, words like indirect or implicit. And my group and now I think a larger group of people latched on to the term implicit because it had been used very effectively by scientists who studied human memory. You know, there are amnesic patients. These are people who can't remember what happened even a few minutes ago. And yet the striking evidence, and it was very exciting when I was in graduate school to read about this work, that they seem to have no recollection in the way in which you and I might remember what was said a few minutes ago. And yet, on an indirect measure, they would show that they had stored that information in their mind. There are funny stories about telling an amnesic patient a joke over and over again, and they can't remember the joke. They can't even remember that you told them a joke. And yet they would laugh less at the punchline, suggesting that they had somehow remembered something about it. And when you ask them, they'd say, it's just not a funny joke. So this sort of – these anecdotes led to lots of beautiful research starting in the late 1970s through the 80s and 90s showing that our brain has different ways of storing information, that some of it is accessible to our conscious awareness, and we call that explicit memory or explicit attitudes. But then there is content that we can't reach easily. We don't even know we have. And that we call implicit or, you know, indirect forms of measuring attitudes and beliefs.
You know, as you're describing that, I'm thinking about a conversation I had recently for this series with Bob Inglis. He's a former congressman, Republican from South Carolina. And he was a very fervent climate science denier who had kind of his mind opened and turned around, and now he runs a group called Republic N, where he tries to educate conservatives about climate science. But he's got a what's interesting about talking to him is he's got a lot of humility and a lot of insight about what you've just described. Like, it wasn't only politics drove his denial of this climate science, but what he began to understand about himself is that even the scientists themselves, he made a universe of assumptions about them. They're not people of faith. Mm-hmm. They're leftist. I mean, run down the list. And he had to really begin to peel back all those individual assumptions to get to, okay, now am I receptive to this science? I found his example, something that's, I think, pretty unique in our political environment, but I think it fits some of what you've just described.
You know, this is the beauty of science for me. I'm sure different people come to it in different ways. But to me, once you understand, you can't hate. You know, once you understand, you see why somebody might be thinking the way they do. And in this moment especially, I have made it my job to speak to people whose views are abhorrent to me.
Really?
I seek them out because not so much to change them, although I would wish that I could do that, but to just see where they're coming from. You know, I mean, among the most educated and progressive people I meet are cab drivers. But every now and then, a cab driver will say something to me like, you know, the Democrats are taking away my Social Security. And I'll ask the next question. Where do you begin? Or the Democrats won't give me health care if I have a precondition. Uh-huh. So what do you do when you confront that? You know, on the one hand, you might want to scream. On the other hand, you say, you know, what you despair about in that moment is that there's somebody here who's not voting in their own self-interest. And so you begin slowly and you tell them that, you know, you're a teacher and you study these sorts of things and you're interested in how that belief came to be. And you realize it's all tied up with so many other things that now have to do with gun control or whatever else. So I think this is just as you said it was Bob
Inglis.
What was his name?
Yeah.
Inglis. Yes, mm-hmm. I have read about him, and I think it's fantastic that we have such people. But it would be very interesting to learn about how he came to see those who talked about climate change as not one monolithic group of people,
right,
even though the data are speaking in one direction overwhelmingly, right? And that's what's so interesting about that. And how he came to it would be interesting. I've seen other politicians change on certain topics. So take Senator Portman from Ohio. Mm-hmm. He had voted pretty regularly against anything involving gay rights. Then his son came out as gay at age 15. And Senator Portman said publicly that he had spent time thinking about this and he had changed his mind. And he got, you know, lots of kudos from gay rights groups and so on. But I actually wasn't that forgiving that quickly. I wanted to ask him, well, why did it not matter to you,
right,
that there were many other parents in the great state of Ohio whose children were gay? And I wanted to ask him, your child is never going to wake up someday and say to you at age 15, Dad, I'm black. That's not going to happen. Are you telling me that until that happens, you won't understand the issues that confront Exactly. Black Americans in Ohio? And so on the one hand, I'm delighted that people change, and I'm delighted that they're putting effort into speaking about how they came to it. But I think if you have any amount of power, if you're a teacher, if you're a senator, if you're a politician, we cannot afford for you to change based on your personal experiences. It is necessary that you know the data. And that I don't think we're there yet. Yeah.
You're listening to the latest episode in our This American Moment series. Our guest is social psychologist Mahzarin Banaji. She studies implicit bias at Harvard. She's co-author, along with Anthony Greenwald, of the book Blind Spot, Hidden Biases of Good People. I had a conversation. This really fits with what you've just said. I had a conversation recently with sociologist and author Robin DiAngelo. She's white. She's written widely about white fragility. And she told this story of what often happens in the workshops. Again, workshops filled with most people who come with good intentions and concern, right?
Mm-hmm.
About mm-hmm. racial bias and by extension, white fragility. And she says, what always happens in these workshops is the first thing she has to do is persuade white people that they are not colorblind, that they haven't come into this conversation and this space with this sense of, which I know this is kind of a cliche, I don't see color. But a lot of people believe that their intentions are so good that they couldn't possibly carry some implicit bias on race. And she says, among everybody that are the hardest to persuade, white progressives the most. What do you make of that?
Hmm. Very good question. And it absolutely rings true with my experience. Look, in the 1970s, I'm sure I said, I'm colorblind. But there is no room for that sentiment anymore because the data have slapped me in the face many, many times. This is where maybe I have an advantage because I have a test. And I can make people look at the test and its result and ask how they're making sense of it. And this is to be done extremely gently. They have to voluntarily mm-hmm. come to it. There should be no mm-hmm. pushing anybody to have this experience. But the most transformative day of my life was when I took that test in 1994. I was simply trying to associate black and white with good and bad attributes, and I thought I could do that quite easily. Half the time I had to associate white with good while I associated black with bad. That seemed very easy to do, so then I switched. Now associate white with bad, black with good. I couldn't do it.
Mm-hmm.
I could do it, but extremely slowly with many more mistakes. Now, when you have that experience, you can't walk away any longer and say, but I'm colorblind. Because if you were, it should have been equally easy for you to do the two. That's just simple. So I think we should use whatever we can, whatever arguments we can. But I'm hopeful that as we design methods that are going to reveal to us what's inside our minds in the same way as we have methods that reveal to us what's inside our body, whether it's an X-ray or a CAT scan or a little blood pressure machine, I think we will bring more people along because human beings, and I will say this, especially Americans, want to confront what's inside them. I mean, you know, go back to the 1930s, this famous book written in the social sciences called An American Dilemma. Gunnar Myrdal was invited by the Carnegie Corporation. A Swedish man was invited to write about the race problem in America because he was seen to be neutral. And he did, and he drove a car through the south of the United States talking to people in diners and in their homes. And I'm quite sure that the intention was to write a book called The Race Problem in America, but he didn't. He titled it An American Dilemma, and I think he did that because, as he writes, he saw people struggle with what they knew to be their religion, what they knew to be their constitution, and the disparity between those on the one hand and their behavior and some of their laws on the other hand. And I think we're in a new moment, a new American moment, but I think it is everywhere in the world. But I do think it is much more sharply being debated in America. And that is, what do we do when the disparity is not just between, you know, our laws and then what our Constitution says, but between two parts of our own minds? Within a single person, there are two individuals. Abraham Lincoln, the emancipator, the person who freed the slaves, as well as the person who believed that black and white can never be equal, that they should not marry, but even more, that they shouldn't work side by side. Both of these things belong to Abraham Lincoln. And I think we carry a little bit of that in each of us.
I love the way you're talking about that, because I just heard a talk about Thomas Jefferson, and you know how, I mean, how ambivalent and confusing the record about who Jefferson was. And I mean, the conclusion was that he represents a lot of the conflicting impulses within all of us. He wanted, aspired to all of that language and the Declaration, and yet did so many of the things that never stood up to that kind of language in the Declaration. Maybe we need to understand that not in a reverence kind of, that example, not in a reverence kind of approach, but in a more humanistic, right, approach.
Yeah. I mean, I have great admiration for Jefferson. There is no question that if you pay attention to his intellect, what Kennedy said when he invited a large group of people over, he said something like, for dinner, he said something like, this is the most distinguished gathering ever to be in this room in the White House, except for when Thomas Jefferson dined alone. And I think that we correctly ascribe to Jefferson and all of those. And then, of course, you look at his moral values and you see the deep conflict of a person of a certain time fighting against his own way of life. But, you know, Annette Gordon Reed, who wrote the book on the Hemingses of Monticello, is a colleague of mine, and I've talked with her about this, and I once wrote her a kind of I was upset at what I had read, that when Jefferson retired, I mean, he kept a few of the Hemingses' kids and their cousins aside, but he did sell his other slaves. And I remember writing to Annette and saying, you know, so why do you say he's so good? He could have let them all go free and he didn't. And she wrote me back such a thoughtful, wonderful note in which she said he was in debt. To him, in that moment, to be in debt was seen as such a terrible thing that he did what he thought was right then. Now, you and I, you know, in 2018 can say he did have a choice. He could have chosen to be in debt and freed his slaves. But it's very easy for us to do that. I think Annette is the one who's, you know, giving us sort of the true historian's perspective that we must understand Jefferson as a person of his times.
I also think that she, Annette Gordon Reed, comes to the understanding of history with a remarkable amount of compassion.
Yeah.
You know, and it's not austere. Yeah.
Yeah. And when she first said what she did, people didn't believe her.
Right.
Then the DNA evidence came in. And I believe there are still people who will say that that's simply not the case. The question is, what do you do? What kind of world do we live in where DNA evidence is not going to be sufficient? Yeah.
Well, what does that say to you?
It says that we've failed as educators. It says, you know, that something's wrong with our society. And I don't want to make too much of college education, because people can be educated in many different ways. And I know a large number of people back at home in India and here who without a college education seem to come to the morally perfect analysis of a situation. But But the fact that only a third of Americans have a college education, I mean, that's shocking on the same scale as, poverty is shocking or climate change and what we're doing about it is shocking. So I do think some of these things get taken care of along the way, that by and large you would understand what DNA evidence means if you took a biology class.
Social psychologist Mahzarin Banaji from Harvard, part of our series This American Moment. Mahzarin Banaji with us from Harvard and the author, along with Anthony Greenwald, of Blind Spot, Hidden Biases of Good People. And she's the latest guest in our series of This American Moment. I'm glad you brought up college because you have an interesting story about making a decision to study social psychology. Tell me if I have this right. You spotted an inexpensive set of books about the subject mm-hmm. when you were heading home from college in India, and you had a long train ride ahead, and you wanted something to read. Is that all true?
It's so true. I was floundering. I had taken a psychology class maybe, but it was not on anything like what I do today. And then I had moved away, and I was studying sociology and anthropology and in a very multidisciplinary school, and none of the methods that I was, they all seemed loosey-goosey to me. I just needed something a little bit tougher. But the problems I wanted to study had to do with how the mind works in our society and in any society. And this was completely accidental that, you know, Indian train stations are kind of little cities unto themselves. You get off the train and there's not only lots of food shops right on the platform where the train is, but there are books. There used to be at least bookstores right there. And I wandered into one and there were a dusty set of five volumes of the Handbook of Social Psychology, 1968. and I asked the guy what the price was. He said something and I said, you know, but I'm not going to pay for the dust on them. So how much can you knock the price down? And he halved it or something. And so I ended up with five fat books, you know, canvas bound in a red in red canvas, and I got on the train and I just flipped through the first volume and my jaw just dropped. I couldn't believe that there was a field where people could study these complicated ways in which we go about making decisions and choices, all unbeknownst to us. And they would mount these amazing experiments in the laboratory where they would make people tell lies and then show that if you told a lie, you would now have to believe that you liked the very thing you had disliked because you had just publicly made this proclamation. And that's the theory of cognitive dissonance. And I had never seen or heard of anything like that. And so I packed my bags and came to Ohio State.
Yeah. Where are the books today?
They are on my shelf.
Are they?
Yes, absolutely. I brought one suitcase with me, a couple of flannel shirts. I'd been told it's cold in Ohio. and those five volumes. Yeah, I packed them all into that one suitcase I brought with me. Yeah,
I love the idea that you were floundering. I mean, embarked, you know, on your education, but you had not found the heartbeat, right, of what your life would be yet. And what a serendipitous moment.
Yeah. I say this to young people that they often think about what do they want to study? What's the topic? And I want to study immigration. I want to study this or that, whatever that might be. And I always ask them to pause and say, think about how do you like studying something? Do you like writing about it? Do you want people to do close readings of your text? Do you want somebody to look at a beautiful differential equation that you wrote out that solves some problem? Do you want to do experiments? We hardly ever think about that, but I think it's a very important question of the method that you want to use to go about analyzing the world. And you know, we have so many now available to us that particular path that we pick is almost as important as the topic we're going to study.
What do you find in your students as they think about, I guess the idea of intellectual risk is what I'm trying to get at, that there may not be answers there, you know, that may follow. You may ask many, many questions for a long time as an academic. How do your students think about that process of inquiry that, you know, involves not necessarily tangible answers and success following quickly?
Yeah, it's a very hard process, because if you decide that you want to live a life of the mind, this country is the place, I would argue, to come to, because you can actually go to graduate school with somebody paying for that if you're good enough. But what does it mean to be good enough? Do you have to have checked off a bunch of boxes? And I would say that today there would be no place for me in any graduate program. Not,
what?
You know,
why?
Yeah, zero. Yeah, no way.
Why?
I came with almost no background in psychology. Now, not only do we require that you be a psychologist at the undergraduate level, but to get into a really good program, you have to have spent 2 years after that working in a lab or demonstrating that you can do research before. So by the time you get to graduate school, you are pretty narrow. I think my students are a lot smarter. They're a lot savvier than I was. But it does make me a little sad that, you know, somebody who has the passion but may not have all the boxes checked off will simply not be able to get into even a B-rated program. It just won't happen anymore. And you ask the question of how my students respond to these demands for it's a hard conversation that happens somewhere halfway through their career, where they're struggling, they're doing everything right, they're working 7 days a week, they're producing amazing stuff, but there are all sorts of demands. I was once told that a student of mine would not get an interview at a university because she only had 8 publications.
Wow.
You know, this would have been unheard of. I got my job at Yale without a single publication. And so now this sort of the bean counting attitude is something that I and people in my department resist. It's very hard when you're sitting with 2 resumes, one with 15 publications and one with 5, to sort of not in some way, the same thing as you and I talked about on voices and how the voice draws us towards it or away from it. It's hard not to be drawn towards the one that's 15. You have to read. You have to not just look at the CV or the resume and say, oh, this one has more. You have to look at whether those 15 are superficial and those 5 are deep. And I will say that there are a few places that continue to say quality over quantity. But I cannot say that that is true across the board. And so it is a harder choice to give up, because you're in your 30s. By the time you're done, everybody who went to college with you is married, has bought a house and a washer and a dryer, and here you are living on a stipend, you know, in a studio, especially if it's in a high standard of living place like Cambridge. It's a very tough choice. On the other hand, I say to them, you'll be the master of everything in your world when you are an academic. You will have no boss. You can dress more or less the way you wish. You can say, after tenure especially, many things that will rub people the wrong way. And the thrill of that and, you know, that calling, and I call it a calling as an irreligious person, I do say that the closest I have come to this experience, that there's something I have to do and I don't care what else it takes to make it happen. I assume people who join the clergy feel that way.
Yeah, I'm surprised now to hear you define yourself as irreligious when I ask you about the song that you chose, as I'm asking all of our guests for this series. You chose "Oh Freedom" by Odetta. There is a soaring, powerful, I think, streak of faith running through that wonderful song. Okay, so what draws you to that music?
Well, you know, I think many forms of religious music are just beautiful music. But I chose that one because I wrote about it not too long ago. I wrote about it in the context of receiving an award, and I decided instead of talking about the last piece of research, I would reflect a little on certain pivotal moments in my life. And I landed on this experience of strangeness. And I talked about three different moments when I came upon strangeness of a certain kind that was unexpected, surprising, perplexing. And one of those experiences was my father taking me to what was called at the time the USIS, the United States Information Service, in our town in South India. And they had just begun to get LPs, and you could now borrow not just books but LPs. And my father, for reasons I don't know, picked that one. And I had never seen a black person in my life. I must have been about 6 or 7, I think. So that was interesting. It was her face on the cover. And then my father played this album. And I can't quite describe in words the kind of electricity that just sort of went through my body from head to toe and back and forth. And I listened to that Freedom Trilogy, dozens of times, just over and over again. My father remembers that I was like mesmerized, that I wouldn't eat dinner with anybody. I just wanted to be in this room and keep listening to it because it was just an amazing quality of voice. I joke that after having had to listen to blaring Bollywood music from the neighbor's radio, this was absolutely strange and beautiful in a way I had. So, yeah, I think we'll understand that lots of atheists go listen to great classical music that is devotional. I love listening to Gregorian chants. I am deeply religious.
Mahzarin Banaji, thank you so much for making some time for the conversation. Wonderful to have you here.
Thank you for having me, and thank you for the show.
You just heard a recording of a live radio show on NPR News. To add your voice to the discussion, you can call in at 800-242-2828 or tweet us at @CarrieNPR. And if you miss us live, you'll find all our shows by subscribing to this podcast. You can send us your questions or comments by emailing talk@npr.org.